Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, October 5th, 2008, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, the financial crisis, the economic crisis that grips this country will grip Media Matters again. We'll be bringing back another economist to try to put everything in context to make some sense and answer your questions. And maybe try to put the current Wall Street crisis in a larger perspective. Also, we'll be joined mid-show, we trust, by a U.S. senator to give his brief take on what's taken place the last week or two on Capitol Hill and where we go from here. So we have a great show for you today of Media Matters. But first, before we go to our program, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Wireless microphones can be found just about everywhere. Theater groups, churches, amateur musicians, karaoke singers across the country use them because they're convenient and versatile. There's only one problem. They're illegal. Harold Feld of the Media Access Project says that people have no idea they may be breaking the law.
Everybody assumes that if I can walk into Radio Shack or find it on Amazon.com and buy it, that there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there is nothing that warns the everyday person who doesn't have a clue about FCC rules that what they're doing is actually a violation of federal law. They don't know they're radio pirates. They think they're just buying a wireless microphone.
Legally, the only people authorized by the FCC to use wireless mics are those people associated with the production of broadcast or cable programming or motion picture production.
It's broadcasters and roving news crews, movie producers, whoever's covering the Super Bowl and other televised sporting events.
Wireless mics operate on the empty frequencies that lie between TV channels, the so-called white spaces. As technology has made wireless mics better and cheaper, their popularity has risen. The industry estimates there are probably about 1 million wireless mics in use. Many of these mics have been illegally squatting in the white spaces, but the FCC and broadcasters have turned a blind eye. But now, those same white spaces may also be the key to providing affordable, wireless, high-speed internet services to millions of Americans. Advocates like Feld are pushing to open the white spaces for unlicensed use to create what some call Wi-Fi on steroids. But the wireless microphone industry has joined with the National Association of Broadcasters, who are strongly opposed to any proposals to open up the white spaces to unlicensed neighbors. They have been lobbying hard in Washington to discredit the potential of white space devices, claiming they can't coexist in harmony with mics and TV channels. New York, with its many Broadway and other entertainment venues, was a prime target for the industry spin. The New York City Council held a hearing this week on a proposed resolution to urge the FCC to refrain from authorizing unlicensed devices in the white spaces. But Feld says these airways are underutilized and will remain so without opening them up to new uses. He's a member of the Public Interest Spectrum Coalition, which is made up of public interest groups and technology companies.
We have a lot of other people who would like to use these empty channels between television stations, the broadcast white spaces. Before, wireless microphones were the only ones who were using it. Now, there is a lot of interest in using that space. The technology companies and a lot of public interest groups who see this as a important way to get rural broadband and broadband in underserved urban areas want it for unlicensed use.
Feld understands that wireless mics have now been woven into the fabric of our cultural life. He's working to preserve wireless mic use without interfering with public safety services or jeopardizing the productive use of the white spaces that could provide better broadband services to those who need it.
What we say is, look, move the wireless microphone guys out of the channels that are being returned because you can't mess with public safety and you can't mess with these new commercial services that are coming in. Recognize these uses and open it up in a real way on the remaining channels, but make them co-equal with any devices that you authorize for broadband use in the white spaces, because frankly, you know, the wireless microphones were there first, but they were illegally there first, so they shouldn't really get a benefit from having been there illegally.
To learn more about white spaces, visit freepress.net/white spaces.
Internet radio stations got another stay of execution this week. In a surprising turn of events, Congress passed the Webcaster Settlement Act, which allows internet radio broadcasters to negotiate for lower royalty rates than those mandated by the Copyright Royalty Board in a controversial decision last March. Webcasters faced increased payments of 300% to 1,200%, a spike in costs that would have forced popular sites like Pandora.com out of business. In response, Congress was flooded with hundreds of thousands of calls from angry internet radio listeners. But legislation stalled in the face of intense lobbying from the big record labels and the National Association of Broadcasters. The bipartisan bill, introduced by Washington Congressman Jay Inslee shortly before Congress prepared to adjourn, permits a negotiated settlement between webcasters and Sound Exchange, the company that collects royalties for performers and the record industry. The fate of internet radio remains up in the air, as rates will still need to be negotiated over the coming months. For more information on the Webcaster Royalty Rate Debate, go to savenetradio.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, this October 5th, 2008. Today, we're fortunate to have as our guest on the air with us an economist who's joined us several times over the course of the history of Media Matters. Mark Weisbrot is our guest today. He works at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He writes widely on economic matters, has been covering the financial crisis, and has written a great deal about the role of the U.S. economy and its future. So it's a privilege for me to welcome Mark Weisbrot to Media Matters today. Mark?
Thanks, Bob. Great to be here.
Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us on what was, again, short notice. We tried to reconfigure our schedule to get some economists on during these weeks to provide some coverage of these issues and get at some of the issues that maybe aren't getting as much attention in the balance of the press. And let me just start, if I can, Mark, if you can lay it out for our listeners. In your view, if someone says, what's the source of this crisis? What is the, you know, we're talking about a financial crisis, but in your view, how would you characterize the broader crisis we're in and what the source of it is?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think that's one of the fundamental misunderstandings in the media and therefore the public at large. And it's so fundamental that it really is, it enabled them to get this terrible bill through Congress, which I'll try to explain. But basically, we're in a serious recession, which is really just starting. And the fundamental cause of that recession is quite obvious. We had an enormous housing bubble that developed between 1996 and 2006. And I say obvious because it was obvious in not just in hindsight, but it was obvious at the time. My co-director, Dean Baker, first started writing papers on it in 2002. You could clearly identify this bubble. And what you could say at that time, which we did say, is that you couldn't say when it would burst because bubbles are psychological phenomena. That is, people will keep buying as long as they think the prices are still going up. But you could say at that time, as early as 2002, that this was a serious bubble in housing and that it would continue to, as long as it grew, the bursting of that bubble would be worse. In other words, the longer it went on, the worse the aftermath was going to be. And you could also say that at that time, and we did say, that you would have a serious financial crisis when that bubble burst because of the financial institutions that had absorbed all of that bad mortgage debt. And so all of those things were true. Now, that is what's going on now. I mean, then there's a financial crisis on top of that, and there's a certain feedback between the two. So as the economy worsens, the real economy, the financial problems of the major financial institutions get worse. And then as those get worse, that worsens the real economy. That's the kind of feedback loop that we're in. So, you know, we have two things that the government is going to have to resolve. One, you know, just to keep the recession from being much worse than it's going to be. In other words, the recession could you know, we could end up, the worst case scenario would be not the Great Depression, as the president tried to scare us with, but would be something like Japan, where you had stagnation that lasted for, you know, most of a decade, where the economy grew relatively slowly. But there's that possibility, which is, I think, not very strong, because I think they will make better decisions in the next few years. I mean, our government will. Or there's the possibility of trying to cut the recession short as much as possible through a big expansionary fiscal policy. Those are the choices that we're going to be facing. So they have to do that, and then they also have to clean up the mess in the banking system, which is a big job.
Mark Weisbrot, our guest today, Media Matters. Mark, you and your partner, Dean Baker, has also been a guest in the program, also accurately anticipated the bubble, the stock market boom, the internet boom of the late 1990s that led to the collapse that contributed to the recession of 2000-2001. And, you know, I saw a headline in The Onion about a month ago saying American people desperate for new bubble for economy to grow on. And it does lead to the question, does our economy require speculative bubbles to have growth?
Well, that was actually a hilarious article in The Onion, and I thought was most hilarious about it was it showed in many ways a greater understanding of the economy than a lot of news articles. That is, they really understood that this expansion of the late 90s and the expansion the 6 years from 2001 to the, you know, whenever the recession officially is going to begin, probably last quarter of last year, that those two expansions were bubble-driven expansions. That is, consumer spending driven by those two asset bubbles really drove the economy during these years. And they really understood that, and that's not really widely understood. You don't even see the word bubble very much in all the news reporting that you're seeing today. It's hardly anyone talks about it. So, yeah, now the question, another very good question that you're asking, which is not being asked, is, you know, why has our economy become dependent on asset bubbles and the consumer spending that drives? And, you know, in the case of the housing bubble, it was a very clear mechanism because people just borrowed against their homes. You know, at the peak of the bubble, they were borrowing $780 billion a year on an annual basis against their homes. I think on net, that's kind of dropped to almost nothing today. So, I would argue, and this is, you know, this gets into a little bit of economics or at least national income accounts. So I hope people will bear with me, but I would argue that the fundamental imbalance here is really the trade balance. So, in other words, when you have, what we call net exports minus imports, okay, that's your trade balance. And we've been running large and increasing deficits now for many years. And, of course, we can do that because we can borrow from the rest of the world. But whereas other countries would, you know, find their currencies collapsing and there would be an adjustment. And so what that does is, you know, as the trade deficit grows, that takes away from the economy. So something else has to make up for that demand. If you import more than you export, then your trade balance is draining the economy. And if that grows, then you're draining it more. And to make up for that, we've had these big asset bubbles. So I think that after this recession, you know, the trade deficit is already adjusting now because the dollar has fallen quite considerably, about 25%. It's lost 25% of its value since 2002 against the trade-weighted basket of currency. So as that trade deficit adjusts, and sadly, I mean, another way for the deficit to adjust is the recession. But what we should have done a long time ago is adjusted it through allowing the dollar to fall, and we didn't do that. And so as a result, I think that's why we were stuck with these asset bubbles. When that balance adjusts to a sustainable level, it doesn't have to be balanced trade. We don't have to have a trade deficit of zero. But when it adjusts to something sustainable, then I think we will have an opportunity, at least, for more balanced growth in the United States.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., along with Dean Baker. Mark Weisbrot and Dean Baker both have been guests on this show. They're among the leading economists who write popular coverage of economic issues in the United States. We're talking about the bailout, the rescue plan, the recession, the financial crisis, what is ahead. And if you have questions for Mark Weisbrot, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Mark, we hope to be joined briefly at the bottom of the hour by U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, just to briefly give us his take on what's taken place in the last week on Congress. Senator Sanders extremely busy. We're hoping to get him for 5, maybe 10 minutes. But otherwise, the show is all ours. Let me ask your opinion. You already referred to the bailout or the rescue plan that Congress has approved. What is your take on it?
Well, I think it's a terrible bill, and almost every economist from, you know, even from the right, but also, you know, to the progressive end of the spectrum, including Stiglitz, thought it was a terrible bill. And that's because it attacks the problem kind of the wrong way by buying these bad assets from the financial institutions and paying a price that's more than, you know, probably a lot more than what they're worth. And so this means that, you know, we, the public, get ripped off for tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars. And it's inefficient. And the worst part of it is that I think the very worst, I mean, you know, being ripped off is, you know, bad enough. I mean, but that happens every day, right? I mean, we have enormous military budget and things like that. That is unnecessary. But the worst part for the people of this country is that when the time comes, which is really now already, but they're not, they're just starting to discuss it, to really have a fiscal stimulus, I mean a large one, you know, enough to keep this recession from being perhaps less severe than the recession of 1980 to 82, these politicians are going to turn around and say, we can't afford this because we just added $850 billion to the national debt. And that's the worst, that I think is the worst thing about it.
You know, Mark, I should interrupt. Maybe you could explain to our listeners, when you talk about a fiscal stimulus, you know, what exactly that means in plain English?
Well, it's very simple. You know, consumer spending is about 71% of the economy. That's what drove the expansion over the last, 7 years, from 2001 to 2000 through 2007. It was really 6 years. And consumers borrowed against their homes. And they can't do that anymore, so that whole process that expanded the economy is working in reverse. And then there's all these other things that are going wrong and sending the economy downward. And so businesses are not going to make up for that drop in consumer spending by investing. So that's not going to do it. So consumption is probably, you know, is declining. It's probably going to come up negative for the third quarter of GDP. The business investment is going to be weak for a while because of the state of the economy. And so the only two other sectors that can help are the government and the net exports. Now, net exports have been helping. That's what's most of the growth we've had for the last year has been because our net exports have increased. That is, imports, the rate of growth of imports has shrunk, and the rate of growth of exports has picked up. But that's not enough. That's only, you know, exports are only 11-12% of the economy.
Actually, even a little more, I actually meant just a very simple explanation of what you mean in terms of government spending and taxation.
Okay, sorry. I guess I'm giving a longer explanation.
Yeah.
So all I mean is that the government sector is going to have to expand spending, borrow and spend, in order to make up for the decline in spending in these other three sectors.
So huge deficit spending, in other words. I mean,
yeah,
bottom line, spend a lot more than you take in taxes.
Yeah.
And this is the standard playbook move that Reagan used in the early 80s, that W. Bush used 5 years ago, that Nixon used in the early 70s?
Yeah, that's right. I think, the thing is they didn't really acknowledge what they were doing, especially Reagan. You know, he claimed that all he was doing was cutting taxes to stimulate the economy, not through consumption. He said that he was doing this to spur investment. And then he also said we needed this big military buildup. But the result was a huge military Keynesian stimulus. He ran huge deficits.
And this is exactly what you're saying we need now, not necessarily through military spending, but through public spending.
We have to. The other reason is because we can't really, there's nothing left of monetary policy. The other way to stimulate the economy is by lowering interest rates. But the Fed has already lowered these interest rates to 2%. And it's not clear that further cuts, which I'm sure they will do, are going to have that much effect.
Let's go to the phone lines now. Our guest today, Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., a frequent guest of ours. We're talking about the financial crisis, the recession, what the politics of it are, what the government's doing, and later in the show we'll be talking about the U.S. role in the world economically and politically, a subject Mark Weisbrot has written about and researched a great deal. First, let's go to line four, Terre Haute, Indiana. You're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Thanks a lot. I am 73 years old. My wife and I are 73 years old. We have no debt. I want to maintain my principal for inheritance for my children and grandchildren, so consequently I want to live on the principal. Where is the best place to put our money now? You indicated earlier that the recession might last for some time.
Yes, well, I try not to give investment advice, but I'll make an exception.
Yeah, for our listeners, you have to.
Yes. First, I would try to keep it somewhat diverse. I think stock market's probably not a good place just yet, but it's getting close. I mean, if it falls, it's not grossly overvalued right now. It's just that because of the recession, it's likely to fall some more before it goes up. But you can't really time the bottom. So I would say, you can invest outside the country, of course, in Asia, for example. Those economies are going to keep growing through this recession. You can also take advantage of the fact that the dollar is going to fall more. It really depends on what kind of, how much risk you want. What you want to bet on.
Sounds like he wants low risk.
Yeah, well, low risk, you can always put it in U.S. treasuries or something. You just don't get much of a return. But I think there's, you can put it, I think personally, if you look at Argentina's bonds, for example, those are paying a very high return. I mean, just a couple weeks ago, you could get 15% there annually, and you could buy something that matured in March of 2011, for example. So,
well, let me stop the investment advice here. As much as I appreciate this new facet of our program,
sure,
because I think we could do personal counsel for all our listeners then. But let me just ask you one question about the stimulus. Getting back to that, if I can, Mark. John McCain in the first presidential debate made a big deal about the fact that the problem with our economy is the government's way too big, and the key thing to do is to balance the budget as soon as humanly possible while expanding military spending and while lowering taxes on the wealthy. That seems like a really, just the balancing the budget part seems like a Herbert Hoover's economic policies, and the second part seems like Ronald Reagan's.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. I don't think, can't think of any economist that would take that seriously, and I don't think it would happen even if he were elected.
our guest, Mark Weisbrot. Let's go quickly back to the phone lines now to another patient caller. Line 1, Spring Bay. You're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Thanks. This is a great program. Well, where to begin? For $750 billion or $800 billion, we could have really started to make a dent in rebuilding the railroads in the country, which everybody seems to think is going to be necessary. Congress, I'm wondering, have they fallen into the trap that everybody else was in a couple of years ago, thinking that house prices are going to keep going up? They sold this package saying, well, we'll hold these mortgage-backed securities for 5 or 6 years, and then we'll sell them back into the market when prices go up. And I don't, I'm asking you, what is the likelihood of prices going up? Because wages seem to be flat, I don't know whether house prices will come up. So I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mark,
no, you can find this on our website at cepr.net. And it's, it's fairly straightforward. Home prices from in the bubble years in the 2006 nationally rose by about 70%, depending what price index you use. If you use Case-Shiller, I think it's even more than that, 80 to 100. So that has to come down 40 to 50% to go back to trend level. And it's fallen about 25% now. So I would say the bubble is between 50 and 60% burst. So in other words, you have a long way to go. And that's assuming that prices don't overshoot.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Okay. Did you catch that part?
Yes, we did.
Okay, because I heard something on my end. Okay. So assuming prices don't overshoot at the bottom, which can happen, right? If the recession gets bad enough, home prices could fall below their trend value. But just assuming they go back to the trend that they've had for the past 50 or 100 years even, they're going to have to fall another 40 to 50%. So that's why I say we're only at the beginning of this recession. And there's nothing you can do about the falling home prices. It would be a mistake to try to stop them from falling. We don't want homes to be unaffordable for moderate-income people, and we don't want overpriced housing. But what we can, there are a lot of things we can do to help people. I mean, we have a bill that was introduced into Congress that CEPR basically put forward.
CEPR being your group.
Yeah, Center for Economic and Policy Research. And it's H.R. 6116. And it would allow people, and this is something we'd want to be included in any bailout, too, going forward, and that is it allows people, if it were passed, it would allow people to stay in their homes, people who can't, who are about to foreclose on their mortgage, can't pay their mortgages, and then there would be a limit. It wouldn't be for, rich people. It would be for homes in a certain range. To stay in their homes as renters and pay the market rent value, which, of course, would be way less than their mortgage, and to pay that indefinitely. And that would save at least these neighborhoods that are, being destroyed by foreclosures. And it would also allow people to stay in their homes. I mean, there's nothing you can do about them not being able to afford the home that they bought, because some of them bought into homes at bubble prices. But at least you can keep them in their homes and keep them from paying an enormous amount of money to stay there.
You know, Mark Weisbrot, we're going to go to Senator Sanders in a few seconds. But before we do, I just wanted to follow up on, you said that you thought the bailout plan that's been approved was a bad one. What are the chances that it might not work? It seems to me there are a lot of economists saying even if it's a bad one, it might not even be effective at, shoring up the crisis in the financial system, and that Paul Krugman, for example, argues we may still have to nationalize all the banks in this country.
Oh, it's absolutely not going to work in the sense of resolving the financial crisis. At best, it'll have some impact, some positive impact, at an enormous cost and enormous waste. But you can see this already. I mean, look, Friday the bill passed. They were telling us that the bill was necessary to keep from the Great Depression, the president was saying. And it didn't even, not only the stock market fell, which isn't really much of an indicator, but the credit markets worsened as well. That's what it was supposed to resolve. It was supposed to assure the credit markets that the government was prepared to do what was necessary to prevent the financial meltdown, and the markets reacted in the opposite manner. And now you see it's going to take, you know, 4 to 6 weeks before they even start to buy any of these troubled assets. So this whole idea that we had to pass this bill right away or the markets would tank was complete nonsense.
Yeah. You know, one last quick point before we get to the senator. You know, how much of the crisis of the financial meltdown was due to deregulation, to the relaxation of the New Deal regulations over financial institutions, and to the emergence of all sorts of new funny money techniques in the credit markets that no one really understands and that were almost entirely unregulated?
Yeah, I would say, you know, a huge part of it. I mean, the only thing I wouldn't want to leave out is the bubble itself, because even if you didn't have these problems in the financial system, the bubble, just the bubble growing and bursting, would cause a recession. That by itself. And that's, but that said, no, that you have this whole banking sector that was not subject to regulation, and now it's going to be, beginning with, of course, the five biggest investment banks, which are no longer, they're now either gone under or they're part of the federal regulatory system now. So that's what's going to be the end result, because these the shadow banking system, as some people have called it, the non-regulated sector of the financial system, was doing the same thing that banks do. You know, they borrow short and they invest and lend long, and there's always a risk that there's a run of some sort, or they have the same risk of collapse that the banking system has. That's why we insure deposits, you know, since the Great Depression, and we subject them to regulation so they don't take risks that can lead to a disaster like this. So this whole sector, including the big investment banks, the hedge funds, private equity, all of them were not subject to the necessary regulation. And so that's what we're looking now is really something similar to the collapse of the commercial banking system, which is regulated.
You know, for the last 30 years, Mark Weisreit, you know better than anyone, American popular discussions of economics have been dominated by the idea that the market, the free market, is really this wonderful, democratic, efficient institution, that the less government involvement there is, the better, that budgets should be balanced, that free enterprise should be unregulated or deregulated as much as possible. Do you think this entire era of sort of, one market under God, as Thomas Frank once called it, is pretty much dead now? Are we at a moment like the 1930s where an entire generation of conventional economic thought is dead, or is this just going to be a blip in the screen?
Well, it's not going to be a blip in the screen, but I wouldn't say anything's dead yet. The trouble is, you know, events have to be interpreted. You know, look at the Iraq War. It's a similar thing, right? Here was a war that was completely unnecessary and it was based on deception and everything else. And, we could get from that, the end of that, a sense of the public that, you know, we shouldn't go to war for things that are not related to our national security. On the other hand, if McCain's narrative wins out, you know, the war was a success. And so, you could say the same thing of the Vietnam War. So how these events play out depends on how they're interpreted in the media and in the public awareness. And I do think that it is the end of an era. There's no doubt about that.
Well, on that note, Mark Weisreit, I'm glad to say that we have joining us on the line for a few minutes the senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, who's been on this show several times and who I think most listeners are familiar was leading the fight against the bailout plan on Capitol Hill for the last 2 weeks. Senator Sanders, welcome to Media Matters.
Good to be with you, Bob.
I really appreciate your taking time from your very busy schedule to join us for a few minutes. And I was just wondering, for the sake of our listeners, if you could give some sense of what the politics were like on the battle over the terms of the bailout plan on Capitol Hill over the last 2 weeks or so.
Well, the truth of the matter is there were relatively fewer people who were in both the banking committee in the Senate and the Financial Services Committee in the House who were actively involved in the details. What disturbed me very much is the Bush administration, through Paulson, came up with this disastrous proposal. proposal which simply said, let's give Mr. Paulson $700 billion to do what he wants to do. It seems to me that, A, the first critique should have been, where were you guys over the last several years? In fact, what you were telling us is how great and strong the economy was, that the fundamentals were strong and so forth and so on. But, B, what I would have liked to have seen, among many other things, is the Democrats say, not only is this proposal, giving $700 billion to one guy without any transparency, without any oversight, without any judicial review, not only is that totally absurd, but given all of the major problems facing our economy, that the middle class is shrinking, poverty is increasing, our health care system is disintegrating, the gap between the very rich and everybody else is growing wider, et cetera, if you need a major bailout, we are going to write it such that it protects the middle class and working families of this country and does not just give $700 billion to Wall Street under the direction of the Bush administration. So what happened is, in fact, the end result is obviously better than the initial proposal from the Bush administration. But to my mind, it doesn't go anywhere near far enough in A, making the people who have benefited from Bush's reckless policies pay for it. I proposed a surtax on household incomes of $1 million or more. It didn't get a whole lot of support. I offered it as an amendment. It was voted down on a voice vote. Not a lot of support. In the House, there was a proposal for a transaction fee, which would have had Wall Street paying for it. Got a little bit more support, but it also didn't go anyplace. And furthermore, in terms of the need for a stimulus package, $1 billion of stimulus can create a hell of a lot of jobs in this country. If we came up with a real stimulus package to rebuild our infrastructure, to move away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy, we could have created millions and millions of good jobs, make some real economic reform. We did not deal with the fact that the cause of this problem was deregulation. We didn't deal with the fact that too big to fail is a doctrine that is worse today than it was before the recent turmoil on Wall Street. So all in all, I voted a very strong no on this bailout and was not happy with the results.
One last question, Senator Sanders, before we let you go. Were you surprised that the head of the Democratic Party and candidate Obama both took such an aggressive role in sort of pushing for a bailout on terms that were really the Bush administration's terms?
No, I wasn't surprised. I was disappointed, but not surprised.
Okay. Well, Bernie Sanders, thank you so much for joining us today. I know how busy you've been, and keep up the great work in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Take care.
Bye-bye. That was Bernie Sanders, the U.S. Senator from Vermont, who took some time from himself just to join us briefly and reiterated some of the points our guest, Mark Weisbrot, made earlier in the show. Mark, any thoughts on what Bernie just said?
Well, it was great. I mean, I totally agree with him. I'm really glad he at least introduced that surtax bill. And, of course, the transaction tax is something that we should keep pushing for. It is a possibility at some point.
Why don't you explain that transaction tax before we go back to the phone lines?
Sure. It basically would be a tax on transactions of securities and all these other instruments. So, you know, stocks, bonds, whatever. You have a very small tax. Currency transactions.
And so, like, if someone sold 100 shares of a stock, they'd have to pay the value of like 0.25%.
Yeah,
it'd be taxed.
That's right.
And they so have speculators would pay a lot of money to the government.
Yeah, and it would also reduce the profitability of having these, you know, this some of this constant trading and flipping and of instruments that don't really contribute to anything. This, you know, this. I don't think we need $62 trillion of credit default swaps, for example, as part of this whole mess. So I think that's important. But, you know, in terms of people voting for this, and I couldn't hear exactly what you said. Of you asked if he was surprised that somebody did.
Oh, the Democrats, the Democratic Party leadership,
yeah,
and
leadership.
Candidate Obama both really worked hard to get this proposal, which really was a refined version of the Bush proposal, passed.
Yeah. Well, if you give me 1 minute, I think I can explain why they did that.
Okay, please
and,
do.
And not defend it either. I think what happened was, it was all a setup, okay? You had Bush standing up there saying that if you don't pass this bill, we're going to have a Great Depression. And you had most of the media accepting that more or less. that this is really urgent. You have to do something. And, you know, the worst part of it is they based it on the last stock market crash, right? Mm-hmm. When the Dow fell, what was it, 7 percentage points in one day.
Mm-hmm.
And, first of all, the stock market, means nothing really relative to this. It really has no, it's not an indicator of the economy or the state of anything. And, because nobody understands what we just talked about, or I should say nobody, lots of people understand, but because the media is not presenting it and most of the public does not understand that we're in a recession, and this recession is something that would happen even if the financial sector problems were resolved, they were able to say, to put the Congress in a very, and Obama campaign too, in a very tough spot. They were able to say what Obama and the Democratic leadership thought and had reason to believe was that if they stop the bill, the Congress is led by Democrats, so even if Republicans voted against it too, which they actually did, majority of them, that the Democratic Congress would get blamed not for just not passing the bill, but for every terrible economic event which is going to happen between now and the election. And there's going to be a lot of bad news between now and the election. And so that's what they did to them. It was really clever in a way. They got it so that they would be blamed for everything that happened in the economy, which was going to happen, even if the bill passed, if they had obstructed the bill. I think that's why they went for it.
I think you're right. Our guest today, Mark Weisbrot, the economist and the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. We've got a full bank of phone calls. I'll do my best to get to all of you right now. Let's go to line 2, Chicago. Thank you very much for your patience. You're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Thank you. Speaking about risks and damages, I just read an article about surgery without scars. I wonder what kind of a scar the whole derivative area is going to cause. Some have described it as a house of cards ready to collapse. And I remember speaking about it years ago. At that time, there was like $150 trillion into derivatives. Banks and other people were putting it in as those who could afford to, the millionaires and all the could afford it, and now it's up in the $400-500 trillion range or even higher. What kind of a scar is that going to be giving us if it collapses?
Thank you very much, caller. Mark Weisbrot?
Well, it is going to contribute to more instability and more failed financial institutions in the future. We don't even know what the hedge funds are holding and how they're being affected right now. So you do have a lot more to come, and these big gambling instruments is what they really, most of them are, these derivatives, are a big part of the problem.
Let's go back to the phone lines again for our guest today on Media Matters, Mark Weisbrot. Let's now go to line 1. Decatur, you're on the air.
Yeah, a quick question. Like you say, this bill was passed, the bailout, with breathtaking speed with no input from other viewpoints. So I'm wondering, just off the wall, how much AIPAC influence might this have had to run that through to bail out the high rollers of Wall Street? And I'll hang up.
Okay, thank you. AIPAC, if I'm not mistaken, is the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee. I wouldn't think offhand this would be their issue. Mark, do you know?
No, I don't think. I didn't see any evidence, and I wouldn't expect there to be any that they were involved in any of this.
Yeah, okay. Let's go back to the phone lines again now. Line 3, Champaign, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for the show. In this bill that passed, most people agree that it's bad, and not much good in it, but it had to be done, supposedly. But what I read recently, it was in the last day of the negotiations for this bill, that they put in a provision that Paulson does have the option of doing a AIG type of a buyout or a equity stake, I think they call it, similar to what Sweden did back in early 1990. So it's bad, but what in the banking lobby, you know, lobbied ferociously against this. But the way I understand it, this was put in, was still in there. And so what do you think the chances of that helping or that even being used? Whereas AIG, okay, you kind of punish the guys. They fired the CEO. The stockholders get wiped out, basically. And the government has an 80% stake in it. So what do you think about those chances of anything like that happening?
Thank you very much, caller. Mark, do you know, is that provision in the bailout package that
there's
passed?
Something like that in there, but I think this bailout has focused the most on, you know, buying up these so-called troubled assets. But I think there's going to be a lot more to come. They're going to have to, you know, they're going to need something that actually does what the caller was talking about with these insolvent institutions, right? Some of these banks and financial institutions, lots of them, are going to turn out to be insolvent, and that means that you know, they can't be saved, and so those are going to have to be bought off and their assets sold off, and you know, like was done with AIG and like was done with bankrupt institutions in the savings and the loan. So there's a whole process of resolving these that's going to have to take place in the next couple of years.
You know, Mark Weisbrot, you've written about the U.S. role in the world. I mean, stand back for a second. Take a broader picture. From where I'm sitting, I'm looking at a U.S. economy that's in really troubled shape, not just short-term in terms of a recession and a financial panic, the sort of usual business cycle stuff. But it seems when you look at the global picture, we're looking at a U.S. economy that's playing, you know, no longer the dominant economy in the manner it's been for the past five or six decades in the world economy, and no longer able to necessarily call the shots. I mean, are we at a moment where the United States is sort of beginning a major transition to a different type of political economy and a different type of economic relationship with the rest of the world?
Yes, I think it is. I think this is something, well, this has already been happening for a while. I mean, in Washington, they're kind of in denial about it, but in Latin America, for example, you know, this is widely known, and you have all these, and we've talked about it on this show before, you have all these left governments now, you know, Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Uruguay, Paraguay, Nicaragua, Honduras. You know, they all recognize in a lot of people as well everywhere that this whole era of neoliberalism has really run its course.
And by neoliberalism, the era of basically having government theoretically do nothing but help the wealthy and powerful and otherwise let business run things?
Well, I would define it a little more specifically. That's certainly part of it. But in, you know, in Latin America and the middle-income countries, what it's meant is an overly restrictive monetary policy, high interest rates, which leads to very slow growth and higher unemployment, you know, cutting the budget unnecessarily, especially in times of recession. If you notice, there's been a lot of articles and a lot of criticism from heads of state of developing countries that they're looking at the United States and they're doing, you know, Lula, for instance, of Brazil said that when they asked him at the UN, you know, about the crisis. He said, what crisis? Go ask Bush. And then he made a bunch of remarks about how these people gave everyone the opposite advice during the crisis in the 90s. And Chavez was probably the funniest one of them. He said, when I nationalize strategic industries, I get criticized, but when Bush does it, it's okay. He said, I think Bush is turning socialist. How are you, Comrade Bush? So they were all making jokes about it, but also very seriously saying, look at all the advice you gave us. And then, you know, the massive privatizations, for example, they had, and the opening up indiscriminately to trade and capital flows that destabilized their economies. So, this is and in the abandonment of development strategies as well, you know. That was another huge part of what happened and what was forcefully pushed by Washington, and primarily through the IMF and the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank and USAID and these institutions, where they were able to have kind of a creditor's cartel, and they were able to tell these governments, if you don't do what we say, you know, you won't get credit from anywhere, and you'll, you know, you'll basically go broke. And that has broken down completely over the last decade in the middle-income countries. So that's why, you know, that's the process that you've seen. Now, what is it going to mean going forward? I think that it's going to intensify that process. I think Europe, it's going to have a huge effect on Europe, because in Europe, you know, in the last decade, they've just been, the media especially, just tells people every day that they have to be more like the U.S., you know, with less regulation, especially in the labor market, and you have to have, you know, because there it's harder to fire people. They have stronger unions and labor laws, and they've been trying to get them to change that. And, you know, Sarkozy won the presidency in 2007 in France, really on that platform, saying that France couldn't afford its welfare state. You know, I always have to point that out because, you know, I appreciate the benefits that the French have, and I do, you know, I think what Sarkozy did was completely false when he said was they couldn't afford this in a global economy. But I think people should, you know, I like to bring this up when people think that, you know, we have this rotten government because people here are stupid. You know, well, you know, you have a certain percentage of people that are ignorant everywhere, but look what happened in France. That's an educated country with a good educational system, and they actually voted for a president who told them they had to lower their living standards, which wasn't true. And so, you know, this can happen anywhere when the media is constantly hammering on this theme. Same thing in Germany, you know, the Social Democratic Party going against its own voters repeatedly, trying to cut back on the guarantees and the benefits that people have there that you don't have in the United States. So I think that that's going to change. I think the Europeans are going to look at the U.S. and say, well, you know, maybe this isn't such a great dynamic form of capitalism that's superior to ours. And maybe even the media will have to recognize that. I mean, look at all of this.
Don't hold your breath.
Oh, I don't know. I think it's going to be noticed. I mean, even Hank Paulson said something recently like the era of naked capitalism is over. I can't remember the exact adjective he used. But
no, Mark Weiser, let me interrupt now because we have one caller I want to get to who
sure.
graciously got off the line so Senator Sanders could get through and now is called back. So it's been winning our all-time Media Matters Patience Award. So let's now go to line two. Urbana, thank you so much. You're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Hi. I was wondering what your view is on the extent to which credit default swaps and their use in a highly speculative and leveraged manner has contributed to this and sort of put it on steroids and how we go about unwinding that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller.
Well, it definitely contributed. I mean, the collapse of AIG was related to, I think, about $430 billion of credit default swaps that they had. So that they had insured, and so I think it has it's definitely contributed to the crisis we're looking at right now, and it will more in the future. How to unwind it? That's a tough question. I mean, it has to be unwound, and I'm not sure how it's going to be done. I think a lot of those insurance policies will turn out to be worthless. But on the other hand, I think the government is not going to allow a lot of the bonds and other assets that the CDSs were insuring to just simply lose their value.
Mark Weisbrot, we've only got a few minutes left. There's a couple other issues I'd like to touch on. For one thing, The Economist magazine just did a survey of American economists, and a majority of them, including Republican economists, thought that Barack Obama's handle on the economy and understanding of economics was superior to that of John McCain. I assume you've had a chance to look at both of their macroeconomic plans for the economy. What's your take on the differences between the two of them going forward and how they will deal with the recession and the economic problems this country faces?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that Obama has more understanding than McCain. McCain pretty much admitted he doesn't understand much about economics. And in the debate, he actually referred to this as a fiscal crisis, which, fiscal crisis would be if the problem was one that the government was spending too much. This is a financial crisis. So those two words are very different. And how would they deal with it differently? Well, I think Obama is more likely especially because the Democratic Party is in this camp, to provide the fiscal stimulus that's going to be necessary. That's going to be the biggest difference. I mean, McCain is talking about a balanced budget. He's not going to balance the budget, but, he would be less likely to support or even allow to pass Congress the necessary spending that Senator Sanders was talking about, that we need to get out of the recession and can accomplish a lot of things at the same time, not trivial at all, especially the environmental, shifting to a more environmentally friendly economy.
Lastly, Mark Weisbrot, as you look at the U.S. economy and its problems today and its potential, do you think in the next 5 to 10 years we could realistically have a rate of growth in the U.S. economy comparable to the 1950s or 60s or even 70s? Or do you think it's more likely that we're looking at a future rate of growth much lower, similar, to even lower than we've enjoyed in the last 10 years? And that we're really realistically looking at an era in which American standard of living is going to be going down?
No. Well, first of all, when you talk about growth, you have to separate out population growth, right? Because
mm-hmm.
if your economy grows just because your population...
Yeah, I mean growth per capita.
Per capita growth. Okay. Yeah, well, that's essentially productivity, and there's no way that... there's no reason that productivity has to really slow down. It's going to slow some compared to, say, 50 years ago, because as countries get richer, they don't grow as fast. But you have to remember, it's not when you have a rich economy like this one, it's really employment and wages that matter more than the actual rate of growth, because we're already quite developed. And that in terms of living standards, there's no way. I mean, living standards are going to increase really no matter what happens, because productivity increases, almost every year, and that means that there's more for everyone.
Mark Weisbrot, we've only got a few seconds left. If our listeners wanted to stay on top of the economy and get sort of a more nuanced or critical perspective, what websites would you recommend or media would you recommend they turn to?
Well, of course, ours is CEPR.net. What else on the economy? I think Krugman has a good blog.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Krugman in the New York Times.
I think we're going to have to leave it at that note, unfortunately. CEPR.net. And Krugman on the Times, because I hear the band tuning up, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. So I want to thank you so much, Mark Weisbrot, for joining us today. We will be back in 1 week with yet another economist, and our Murderers Row of Economists, Bob Kuttner, will be joining us. Until then, everyone, have a great week. And again, thank you very much, Mark, and thank you, Andrew Boyle, my producer.
Thanks, Bob.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.